Ready? Good evening, everybody. I'm sorry about the delay that we had to let you wait. This is the third annual collaboration co-hosting event the Hellenic Bankers Association is doing with the LSE. And we want to thank Professor Featherstone, his tireless team, for this collaboration, and we look forward to continue this in the years to come. Our aim at HBA is to offer a forum for constructive ideas that are echoed in the European capitals. The seven last years of austerity had a tremendous cost for people in Greece and to varying degrees to many others in the South European countries. We want to thank our distinguished panelists for being here today and in what we hope to be a very informative and controlled, lively discussion. Professor Featherstone.
Thank you. Thank you, Stratos, and may I give my thanks on behalf of the Hellenic Observatory, of which I'm the director, to the Hellenic Bankers Association for this continued collaboration. We look forward to many future events of equal interest. As Stratos has indicated, we have a distinguished panel to discuss two questions. Is austerity winning the arguments on Eurozone recovery? And can the solutions to the crisis also be socially just? There's a certain topicality about our discussion this evening, not only on a European-wide basis, but of course, especially in the Greek case. We read today that the official figures for Greek unemployment in January gave Greek unemployment at 25.7%, a reminder of some of the consequences of the current crisis. So we have four distinguished speakers, and they're going to speak in this particular order. Paul Mason, on my far right here, is a journalist and broadcaster. He's the economics editor of Channel 4 News. He was previously the economics editor of BBC Two's Newsnight programme. He is the author of several books, I'm sure you're aware, and he's a visiting professor at the University of Wolverhampton. Holger Schmeiding, on my far left, is the chief economist at Berenberg Bank and a frequent broadcaster and commentator on economic affairs in the media. Before joining Berenberg, he was a senior economic advisor to the IMF, a senior strategist at the Bank of America, and he has also worked for Merrill Lynch. He studied economics in Munich, London, and Kiel. He obtained his PhD at the University of Kiel, but more importantly than that, he obtained his master's from the London School of Economics. Yanis Milios is professor of political economy, here on my left. Yanis Milios is professor of political economy and on the history of economic thought at the National Technical University of Athens, and he is a member of the Central Committee of Syriza. He's published widely and has authored or co-authored several scholarly books on political economy. Last but certainly not least, on my right here, Miranda Ksefa is a senior scholar at the Center for International Governance, Innovation, and is a former member of the IMF Executive Board. She holds a PhD in economics from the University of Pennsylvania and has taught economics at the Universities of Pennsylvania and Princeton. She's published several articles and papers on international economic and financial issues. So we have a breadth of expertise, and certainly, I think, as will become evident, a breadth of interpretation and argument. I've invited each of these speakers to speak to you for about 8 minutes. And so if you see me waving at the speaker, it isn't because I've suddenly become friendly. It is to indicate that time is running out. On that basis, if each speaker speaks for about 8 minutes or so, there should be plenty of time for me then to open up the discussion to you in the audience, both downstairs and upstairs, and I'll invite questions at that stage. So we're discussing, is austerity winning the argument on Eurozone recovery, And can the solutions to the crisis also be socially just? Can I invite Paul Mason to start us off?
Well, thank you for that. In the 8 minutes, I can only be quite angular to try and put things out there that we can discuss. Of course, austerity isn't winning the argument on Eurozone recovery. There is no Eurozone recovery. Inflation recovered to zero today in Greece, where austerity has been tried the most. It had destroyed human potential the greatest. Austerity lost the argument the moment Olivier Blanchard, the IMF's chief economist, admitted that the IMF's... and the IMF had the more sophisticated economic model of the multiplier effect on austerity, that the IMF's model was wrong. And of course, we didn't need that admission because the predicted short-term V-shaped recovery of Greece had already turned into a 25% loss of GDP, 25% fall in wages, 25%+ unemployment, 60%+ youth unemployment. So of course, no, austerity is winning the argument among, it's not even a 1%, it's a tiny sub 1% section of society that happens to include most bank economists, most professional economists, most politicians, and all members of the global elite. That's where it's winning the argument. Everywhere else, it's losing the argument. And you only have to do, as I've done, reporting from the streets of Greece, from the communities of Greece, of Spain, Portugal, parts of southern Italy, to realise, and Ireland, to realise that people don't buy austerity at all. I'll come to the second part of the answer in a minute. But to try, I think my job here is to try and orientate us in the widest possible canvas. What's going on? How do we contextualise Greece and the austerity drive in Europe? Vladimir Putin is trying to destroy Europe as a global power in order to detach it from the United States and to reorder power in the globe. That's my take on the situation we're in. ISIS is a sideshow compared to that, which is the main thing that's going on. What is Europe's response? Europe's response is to destroy itself. And the self-destruct mechanism is being led not by Greece, but by Germany. I think it's a caricature to say, you know, Germany is destroying democracy in Greece. No, it's doing much more than that. It is destroying the Eurozone as a project. And this is not just a small group of elite German politicians not listening to people. It is a large section of the German political class, including, as we found out, Joschka Fischer today, who are listening to their own people. And their own people have given up. You go to the small towns in eastern and southern Germany, in Bavaria and in former East Germany, and you will hear people say, we have no social solidarity whatsoever with the people of Greece, Portugal or Spain. We don't even want to share a currency with them. We prefer if we didn't. But above all, we are not prepared to pay any more of the costs of bailout, as they see it. They have not been told by their own press that 90% of the money used by North European governments to give to Greece was immediately recycled back into the French and German banking system to save that rather than Greece. And even if they were told, that they wouldn't buy it. They have left the hotel called European Solidarity. They have checked out of it. And I'm afraid that is the precondition for something that goes much beyond whether or not what we now see, the drama that's playing out in front of us, which is the smashing of Greek democracy by the ECB, by the Commission, by the Eurogroup. It's much bigger than that. Because when people in whose living memory the swastika flew above the Acropolis, when they see politicians, you know, the newly minted right-wing politicians in their badly fitting suits arrive in Brussels to vote dutifully alongside Germany for the smashing of Greek democracy from Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovenia, countries that didn't exist, you know, when the Euro project was founded, when the European project was founded, there's only one conclusion. And I think we economists are quite shy at drawing conclusions. Speak to the people at Chatham House. Speak to the people at RUSI. Speak to people in the British and American military and the State Department, State Department people in Athens. And they will tell you what the outcome is. Forget Article 5 of NATO. Forget it. Because the idea that a Greek conscript is going to go and give their life for Estonia when Vladimir Putin comes to take it is becoming less and less likely the more the Greek people see the way their country is being treated by these institutions. We have to be, I think, critical of what Syriza has done in the time it's been in power. And I'd be interested to see what John thinks about this. I've interviewed you a couple of times and I'm in fairly constant contact with people in the Syriza leadership. My big criticism is the same criticism I would throw at myself, actually, is that they believed, and I believed, in the good euro. I believed that Matteo Renzi and Hollande and people like even people like Dijsselbloem, in the end, had at heart the idea that this project should carry on despite the sacrifices needed to be made to do it. And that if Greece were to go leftist, as we all understand, it went leftist, and after it's been leftist, if that government should collapse, there'll be a very right-wing government of what's left of conservatism, probably followed by a chaotic collapse, probably followed by a fascist government. So that's the sequence. And if that happens, we want to stop it. I thought that the combined sort of force of the kind of soft Keynesians, Draghi, Renzi et al., would be able to persuade the European institutions to come to a deal with Greece. And so did Syriza. That was their mistake. And every time they tried to do it, and you talk to them, I don't know about Jan himself, but some of the other ministers, including Euclid Tsakalatos, who's now leading the negotiations, they are existentially pro-euro. They cannot imagine, they will never, ever leave the euro voluntarily. And they got into their minds that it was possible to reform the project and that the argument could be won with some negotiation on both sides. That was what was wrong, because they weren't negotiating with the Eurogroup, they weren't negotiating with the Council of Europe, they're not really negotiating with the institutions. Every time those institutions attempt a political solution, up pops Schäuble or somebody else from Germany and somebody else we've never heard of before from the Baltic states, and they block it. So we have to draw conclusions from this, provisional ones. My provisional conclusion would be we should still try to save this thing, but if it doesn't want to be saved, if there is only the blocking mechanism, only the blocking reflex that's going to happen, we'll first see the smashing of Greek democracy by the ECB, then we'll see chaos in Greece, and then the project itself will be over. And if you think that's not possible, imagine the night when they walked out of this building to find newspapers saying the Anschluss, or the breakdown of peace in Europe, or the outbreak of World War I. Everything bad is possible when global collaboration falls apart.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. I wish you'd been provocative. Our next speaker is Holger Schmeiding. Can you find anything to disagree with, Holger?
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah, thanks, Paul. I have to say, first of all, I'm German. So, indeed, I'm one of those Germans who occasionally pop up to, I'm afraid, have a different view. And the assertion that we have checked out of hotel solidarity, we can discuss that at length. But remember that the parliaments of Europe, the Eurozone, have put more than 400 billion euro at stake in support for other euro members, for Portugal, for Ireland, to some extent for Spain, for Greece, for Cyprus. That's a lot of money to put at stake. You may call that checking out of hotel solidarity, but let's have a discussion about that. Austerity. What is it? Well, it's a medicine. The question is not whether it's good or wrong, good or bad, whether it's right or wrong. The question is whether it's the appropriate medicine for a certain situation. If you have lived beyond your means, you have to do something about it. If nobody is ready to lend you any money and you're running a deficit, you have a problem. The question about austerity is it appropriate? Is it the right doses? Before we talk about the Greek case, just a bit of basic economics, as this is one of the lecture halls where I did learn my basic economics. Forgive me this half-minute indulgence in it. We have to distinguish between demand and supply. We need to look at both. What the discussions in Europe are about are short-term fiscal repair, which is mostly relevant for the demand side. But it's also about long-term growth potential, how to get that up. So, on the one hand, we have a discussion about austerity. cutting government spending or raising taxes. That often, not always, but often can hurt aggregate demand. Then we have a discussion about pro-growth structural reforms, making labour and product markets more flexible, preventing Greek labour markets from returning to what in this country was the labour market in all of its pre-Thatcher glory. I was here in 1980. We had big debates about labour markets at the time, about Britain. So pro-growth structural reforms are about what Thatcher did to the British labour market. It's about making it easier to open and grow a business, make the public administration more efficient, improve incentives to work and invest, that is, to raise the long-term growth rate of supply. Now, let's look a bit at Greece, how I see it as an outsider. The country had a dramatic fiscal shortfall, about 15% of its GDP in 2009. That was even worse than this country, which was otherwise pretty much leading the Western world, with a shortfall of about 10% of GDP in Britain, roughly matched by that of the US. I think the US was more like 11%. Greece needed to do something about that. The situation in Greece, however, was also that Greece was an inflexible and comparatively closed economy, with a weak administration. Greece had to ask for help. It did get help. The program which Greece did was not the best. There were some mistakes made in the program, serious mistakes. First of all, Greece and the Troika jointly found it easier to raise taxes than to issue more licenses for taxes, than to deregulate the economy, than to tell public sector servants, don't meddle. Cut the meddling. Let them do their business, the people. There was, all in all, far too much focus on short-term fiscal repair, which was necessary, but it was too much. Especially from 2011 to 2013, tax increases and expenditure cuts were too heavy. And, of course, when you have significant austerity and are not at the same time doing enough to make the economy more flexible, more responsive, to take advantage of opportunity, then you get a fairly significant shock to overall demand, to overall aggregate GDP. The result was the Greek recession was sharper than it should have been. After the overspending of 2009, a recession was inevitable, but it was sharper and lasted longer than it should have done. The second mistake was, once again, jointly by the institutions and the Greek administration of the time. The second mistake was to not take account of the weakness of the Greek administration. Greece does not need higher, more complicated taxes. It does not need extra taxes on A and B. It needs a flat tax. It needs a simple system. It needs simple regulations so that even a weak bureaucracy can administer that. That's the key thing, and it didn't get that. So having a complex reform program with a weak administration meant that a lot of reforms were not fully implemented, adding to the problem that the economy, which was having a fiscal shock, did not have enough supply responsivity. However, this was up until 2013. In 2014, there was no further austerity. There actually was a slight fiscal stimulus. Greece had finally done all the hard fiscal work, basically, that was needed. And it was showing a lot of success. Now I would like to draw your attention to the chart here. What you see there in the bluish line is Greek corporate confidence, which after the post-Lehman recession never really recovered in the period of austerity, which for quite a while was below the Spanish line. And then came the recovery, which in confidence started at the end of 2012, jointly with Spain, which at the end of 2013 brought the country finally back to some economic growth. In the first three quarters of last year, the best growing economies in the Eurozone were Ireland, Greece, and Spain, with a major drop in unemployment in all these countries from extremely high levels, unfortunately, in Greece, but a drop in unemployment. Greece was, late last year, absolutely on the right track. And then look what happened afterwards. Look at the end of the chart. You see what happened when Syriza got close to power and came to power. I have never seen a new government do so much economic damage in such a short time than this government. Spain continues on its recovery path. It today published a number for GDP growth, which, if we annualize it US style, was 3.6%. That's a lot. That's a lot of jobs. That's what Greece could have had if it had not had this political accident, which the country did have. You do see how the blue line, since the rise of Syriza to power, has gone down. We have seen within 3 months capital flight out of Greece, 50 billion euros. That is 28% of Greece's national GDP per year. That is devastating. Greece is probably now, after the Samaras recovery from last year, in the Tsipras recession of this year. I do hope very much that Tsipras will ultimately put power over dogma, that he will return more or less to the policies of 2014, which were bearing fruit, not to the excessive austerity of 2011 to 2013, which was excessive, very much, a mistake of all parties combined, but to the policies which last year were starting to bear fruit, which had put Greece on a Spanish-style recovery track, a recovery which at the moment, unfortunately, looks at the risk of being aborted or at least of being interrupted. My personal view is I see a 70% chance that this government will come to its senses, possibly shedding its absolutely lunatic coalition partner, possibly shedding the left wing of the major governing party, to then hopefully form an alliance of the more responsible, say, social democratic stratum of Greek political society, and then keep the country in the euro and stay on the reform path for a significant Greek recovery, just like Spain is enjoying it now, and just like Ireland is enjoying, and Portugal seems to be on the verge of enjoying it as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I think it's going to be a lively debate, isn't it? Yanni. We did indeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Stratos and Kevin, for this invitation. I'm going to... Okay. No, I don't have any slides.
But I can put it back to
one. Okay. Sorry.
It's fine.
Okay. I'm going to read a text so that I will be sure that I will be within the 7.5 minutes limit. So, in order to answer to the questions posited by the organizers of today's discussion, we shall first comprehend the social content and the workings of austerity. The following four theses summarize my theoretical view. First, austerity constitutes the keystone of neoliberal policies. On the surface, it appears as a strategy of reducing entrepreneurial cost. Austerity reduces the labor cost of the private sector, increases profit per labor unit cost, and thereon boosts the profit rate. It is complemented by economy in the use of material capital and by institutional changes that, on the one hand, enhance capital mobility and competition, and on the other, strengthen the power of managers in the enterprise and of bondholders in society. As regards fiscal consolidation, austerity gives priority to budget cuts over public revenue, reducing taxes on capital and downsizing the welfare state. Second, however, what is cost for the entrepreneurial class, for the capitalist class, is the living standard of the working majority of society. This applies also to the welfare state, whose services can be perceived as a form of social wage. Third, it is clear then that austerity is first and above a class policy. It constantly promotes the interests of capital against those of the workers, professionals, pensioners, and other vulnerable groups. On the long run, it aims at creating a model of labor with fewer rights and less social protection, with low and flexible wages, and the absence of any meaningful bargaining power. Fourth, the institutional arrangement of the Eurozone, with the ECB being deprived the power of a lender of last resort, deliberately reinforces neoliberal policies. Member states will not always have the necessary liquidity to pay off bondholders. This will make the downsizing of the welfare state a precondition for financial solvency. The ruling European elites have thus voluntarily subjected themselves to a high degree of sovereign default risk in order to consolidate the neoliberal strategies. In other words, they have jointly, including the Greek or the Spanish ruling elites, decided to exploit the crisis as a means to further neoliberalize state governance. From the above thesis becomes apparent that austerity wins the argument with the mainstream mass media and intellectuals who support the class views and interests of the ruling class elites. However, it can hardly win the argument with the working majority, even not in marginal conjunctures of crisis, when the elites portray any alternative to neoliberalism as a disaster. The working majority will always be opposed to shrinking wages and precarious employment, to degeneration and cutback of public services, raising the cost of education and health care, weakening of democratic institutions, strengthening of repression. They will always conceive the crisis of labor, that is, unemployment, precarious and underpaid work, etc., as a social illness by itself, a social illness that shall be tackled not as a side effect of the recovery of profits, but as a social problem. The inner workings of an enterprise constitute a battlefield between antagonistic interests. As Karl Marx commented on the limits of the working day, quote, "The capitalist maintains his rights as a purchaser when he tries to make the working day as long as possible. On the other hand, the laborer maintains his right as seller when he wishes to reduce the working day to one of definite normal duration. There is here, therefore, an antinomy of right against right, both equally bearing the seal of the law of exchange. Between equal rights, force decides," unquote. The continuation of austerity is a matter of the social relation of forces. If austerity persists, the European welfare model will be remembered as a bad joke. Beyond certain limits, the subjection of all parts of social life to the unfettered function of markets and the dictate of profitability may function as political risk for the neoliberal establishment, since it can easily trigger uncontrolled social outbreaks. As Franklin D. Roosevelt stated in his speech at Madison Square Garden, New York City, on October 31, 1936, quote, "We know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob," unquote. From historical experience, we know that an alternative to austerity and neoliberalism does exist. The European social model must and can be refounded. Social needs must gain priority over organized money. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Miranda.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm sorry. How do I move back and forth with this? Oh, yeah. Okay. Hello, and thank you for coming tonight. I have 16 slides, so I will allocate about 30 seconds per slide. So this is a picture of the euro area periphery real GDP. I take as the base year 2007, that's the pre-crisis level, and we see that real GDP has not returned to the pre-crisis level in any of the countries of the periphery, but Greece is really an outlier with a nearly 25% decline in real GDP since 2007. And actually notice that the decline did not start with a memorandum in 2010, but the drop in GDP is already apparent in 2008 and 2009, years in which the Greek government attempted to overcome the recession by spending its way into the crisis. This, of course, has added to the debt burden, and you can see that in Greece, the debt burden is now higher than it was in 2011, when the debt exchange was already under negotiation. Even though the nominal debt has been cut by 106 billion due to the debt exchange and by a further 20 billion due to the subsequent debt buyback, because the denominator has also been declining, the debt ratio is now higher than it was back then. Now, austerity. Austerity is not a choice. It's not something that you choose to do, but then you may decide not to do it. Countries that have lost market access, like Greece, or faced high-risk premia, like Spain and Italy did in 2011 and 12, have no choice. They have to bring their budget deficits to a sustainable fiscal path in order to get official funding from the European Stability Mechanism and from the IMF. Creditors are not going to just hand out cash if they are throwing it in a bottomless pit. They want to make sure that the country is on a path to sustainable growth and debt. So in the euro area periphery, austerity is not a matter of fine-tuning demand. This is not a Keynesian world. It's a way of ensuring that the government remains solvent. Solvency, in turn, depends on growth prospects, much more than it does on today's debt ratio. And that's where structural policies to promote growth come in. Austerity is good for solvency. If the fiscal multiplier is greater than one, then a deficit reduction may indeed lead to a fall in GDP that exceeds the deficit reduction. This is what Finance Minister Varoufakis calls the austerity trap. But a cut in expenditure today will lead to higher GDP in the longer term because it allows for tax cuts that stimulate economic activity. So austerity is good for solvency in the long term, even if it raises the debt-to-GDP ratio in the short term. So the conclusion of this is that the increase in the debt-to-GDP ratios in southern Europe should not necessarily be interpreted as evidence that austerity does not work. Look at Greece. It seems that now we are going back to a double-dip recession, just as Greece was emerging from 6 years of recession. Due to the uncertainty created by the elections that we had in January of 2015, since the election, we've had three months of protracted negotiations that have created so much uncertainty that all investment intentions and plans have been put on hold. The government is generating arrears and this to the private sector, and this adds to the credit crunch. And there is no immediate prospect of a return to a growth path. This is the economic sentiment indicator for Greece. In fact, that chart was prepared before the data that came out yesterday, showing that in April there was a continued big decline in the economic sentiment indicator for Greece. These are the investment ratios, not just for Greece, but for all the euro area periphery countries. You can see how deep the cut is in investment in Greece in particular. Exports are picking up part of the slack, but not in Greece. And this is really where the problem is. The problem is not austerity. The problem is that Greece does not produce enough goods and services that other people want to buy. And when your debt is owed to foreigners, the only way you can service your debt is by exporting. If the debt is due to domestic residents, then you can always raise the money you need to service it through taxation. But you cannot do that when the debt is due to foreigners, as is the case in Greece. This is the World Bank's Doing Business report, where Greece has improved its rank, no question about it, in the past 5 years. The global rank of Greece now is 61st, up from 72nd last year, but it is 17th out of the 19th euro area countries, so that's a pretty low rank. And if you look at the specific indices that make up the overall index of competitiveness, Greece is unbelievably low in some areas, like registering property. Greece is 116th out of 189 countries. Enforcing contracts, Greece is 155th. And resolving insolvency, where you have to be in the courts for years and years when your business doesn't go well and you want to resolve it.
Can you speed up, Miranda, please?
Yes. Greek bank deposits are down. But let's look at what happened in the run-up to the global crisis. Greece's per capita income growth was faster than anybody else's in the euro area periphery except Ireland. But Greece's debt ratio rose in this decade, whereas it fell in the other countries. So look at the numbers. In Greece, per capita income growth cumulative was 43% during the pre-crisis decade, but its public debt ratio went up 11 percentage points of GDP. So Greece did not do too badly if you look at the entire period from 97 to last year. It certainly did better than Italy. Italy's per capita income has only gone up 1% cumulative throughout this period. Greece's is the same as Portugal, but lower than Spain or Ireland's. After the PSI, of course, the debt remains very high. But the debt service is very low. This table shows the interest that Greece has to pay on public debt on an accrual basis. But on a cash basis, the amount it has to pay is much lower because the interest due to the EFSF/ESM has been capitalized for 10 years. And also the ECB is returning to Greece the profits on the GGBs that it bought under the S&P profits. So The average interest that Greece is paying is just 3.1% of GDP on a cash basis. And as a percent of the stock of debt, it's 1.8%. So it's peanuts. So the problem is not the debt. The problem is the export base, and it's the fact that Greece cannot compete internationally. And that's where this government should turn its attention to. But all it talks about is redistributing income. There is never talking about wealth creation, only about redistribution. And this is not going to work. Thank you.
Okay, thank you to each of the speakers for getting us off to such a good start with the debate. We now have the opportunity of you posing questions from the audience. Can I invite questions, but precisely to invite questions rather than speeches, please? There are microphones available from colleagues on the right here. When asking a question, could you simply tell us who you are and then ask the question? And we'll take three or four questions at a time. Who would like to begin, please? Could we take, I'm sorry, right on the far side here. If you could just wait for the microphone, please. I should explain, we're waiting for the microphone because the debate is recorded.
Ronan Tynan. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I must thank all the speakers for a very fascinating presentation, because I think tonight I discovered the difference between the economy and the political economy. And I would put it to all the speakers that the economy as such doesn't really exist. Only a political economy exists. And I must compliment Paul Mace in particular on a brilliantly analytical presentation, where he clearly brought home to us the reality, which again I put it to all the panel, that there's absolutely no hope for the Eurozone without us recognising the political implications of the serious economic decisions. And I would put it to the panel that it's very interesting.
Okay. We're inviting a question, though, please.
Oh, yeah, well, I'll frame in a question. I just want to put it to the German economist in particular. Is it not ludicrously dangerous to bank on a massive, almost another political revolution in Greece, the breakup of the coalition, etc., to avoid Greece leaving the Eurozone? And I'll have to say this, Mr. Chairman, again, because I thought Paul Mason really amplified the challenge straight away, but I mean, the risk of Greece leaving the Eurozone, I put it to the panel as well, will mean the end of the Eurozone in the same way that we did not anticipate the really serious and devastating implications of the Lehman collapse. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Here as well, please.
Hello, my name is Petros Priselis. So that's a question to Ms. Xafa. So you mentioned that you know, in order to have long-term growth, there needs to be some sort of raise in the, you know, in the production base. There have to be wealth creation, etc., which I tend to agree. What I would like your opinion on is to give us some ideas of the sectors in Greece and the industries that could actually help Greece do that, and you know, raise exports and all the other stuff that you talked about, because that's an opinion here, a very quick one. I mean, we've seen that even in the past, even in the good days of Greece, a lot of the industries that were profitable or were doing well, they were mainly focused on doing business with state entities, right? So is that sustainable?
Okay, good, thank you. And right at the very front here, please. So if you wait for the microphone, because it's being recorded and people won't hear you.
Apostolos Gouzinis, I'm a lawyer. A question to Mr. Mason. I mean, you obviously discussed all the things that Europe didn't do, but thinking about the financing of the Greek deficit, which was enormous, the largest debt restructuring in the history of the world, unlimited amounts of support to the Greek banks by the ECB, I think, you know, you get my drift. I think I'll go on and on and on about all the things that Europe has done, but you seem to think that they didn't do enough. So what more could they do without undermining political support in, you know, the 24 other countries that also have, you know, electorates, and they also have budget constraints, and they also have constituents that they need to adhere to?
Okay, good. Paul, do you want to start off?
Just to make two points then. One, I think I can agree with, there's one thing we can agree on, and that is that the structural problem with Greece is unique. That what you saw on your graphs, Miranda, I think is an illustration that Greece is the outlier, and it's an outlier structurally. That is, it's a country that's been run by an oligarchy that, you know, from since the Varkiza period, to be honest, it's not that necessary that all of them were implicated in loads of corruption, that all of them are going to go to jail, etc. But the fact is that there was a social truce between the oligarchy and a kind of economy that does not respond to treatment. And it doesn't respond particularly to the kind of treatment that the IMF, ECB and the Commission prescribed for it. That's where our differences diverge. Begin. And that, therefore, what should they have done? What could they have done? First of all, they could have looked in 2009, 2010 and said, first of all, the culpability lies in Eurostat and the former New Democracy government, which cooked the books, number one. Therefore, it's a joint culpability. Number two, given the level of structural challenge in this economy, the level of lack of export industry, the level of reliance, as you say, sir, of the private sector on the state sector, it's not going to respond to austerity. What's going to happen is it's going to have a 1930s-style collapse. And as people like me and other commentators from the streets of Greece said, this is happening, the social collapse is happening, the rise of fascism is happening, the infiltration of the police by fascists is happening, the collusion of government ministers with fascists in back rooms is happening, Europe should have listened and done something different, but it didn't. That's my short answer. But, you know, if you are... You have stewardship over an economy, and this central bank is losing year by year and month by month any credibility it had. If you have stewardship, if the Bank of England saw a region of Britain, i.e., part of its remit, suddenly become subject to massive deficits, massive capital flight, destabilizing the whole polity that central bank was supposed to look after. Any normal central bank would step in and stem the crisis. This isn't the Tsipras recession. This is the Draghi recession. No. This is the Schäuble recession. This is the Bundesbank recession, to be honest. This recession has been foisted on Greece by European Central Bank policy. And in fact, the bank run began, as did the capital flight, began before. And it began at the point when the ECB and the IMF insisted on this brilliantly recovering economy you describe, that it should run a 4.5% budget surplus, which is impossible and would always bring down the government.
Okay.
It was them who's caused this. Syriza has made some mistakes, but it's the ECB's problem.
Can I just follow up, Paul, with one question which lingered from your presentation, but could I simply ask you to give a very brief answer? Part of your argument was that the ECB has destroyed democracy in Greece. This is a club of 19 countries. What about democracy in the other 18 Eurozone countries? German voters also have equal rights, do they not?
Yeah, they do. But, you know, the point about a central bank is that it's not democratically accountable. If you look at the British Central Bank, it doesn't care who runs Westminster. It acts in the interest of monetary and financial stability for the whole part that it, as does the Fed, the whole country for which it has a remit. And what has happened with the ECB is it stimulated a catastrophic run on the Greek banks in order to leverage its own negotiating position.
Okay.
And I think that's my argument.
Okay. Miranda?
It's funny that you think that this is Draghi's recession just as he started buying 60 billion of assets per month. But to respond to the question of the gentleman who asked about the sectors, I mean, I'm not a central planner, so I don't know what the sectors are. I think businessmen will decide what the right sectors are. But as a policymaker, I would just set the regulatory environment and the tax environment straight. You know, Greece has private oligopolies that are created by the state licensing system, and it has a lot of state monopolies that produce low quality and expensive goods and services. So we need a much smaller state sector. We need a government that gets out of the way of market forces. Greece is suffering from a government that has set barriers to entry, has created closed shops, closed professions, has set profit margins and remunerations in a number of professions. So it is a very heavily regulated economy that has a huge state sector trying to implement regulations that are often contradictory. And it has a tax system that changes not just by every government, but every year we see changes. So this is not an environment that can attract investment and create an environment of certainty for people who put their money on the line.
Thank you. Yanni, would you like to respond to any point?
Yeah. I would like to comment on the export question. Let's look at Germany. Is Germany a country producing cheap products? Is the fact that wages were kept low over the last two decades, that Germany has this enormous success on the world markets? My answer is no. The German products are relatively expensive compared to other products, but we see that Germany possesses a qualitative competitiveness. That is, it exports 18% of the complex medium high technology products in the world, and is not in the competition with China and the Chinese products because it produces something else. So the problem, if we discuss exports regarding Southern Europe, is a problem of technology, organization, is a problem of upmarket products which are produced and exported in a very low percentage compared to other countries. Now, let's look at austerity. What does austerity do when it stabilizes profits only or mainly by cutting the wage share? It gives air and breath to the underdeveloped fractions of the entrepreneurial world of capital to continue to exist in the market, producing low technology products which are to a very high degree competitive with the Chinese ones. And so we enter a vicious cycle, and as you know, for historical and other reasons, which have to do with the relation of forces, the European wages will never be as low as the ones in China or even not as the ones in South Korea. So what austerity does is to keep things as they are, because it's something that spontaneously comes from the immediate, from the short-term interest of the entrepreneur. If we take the entrepreneurs as a class, as a social group, and I finish with that, it is ridiculous to expect from them to distribute money to the people in order to buy their own products. Seen as a class, as a social group, it's obvious that they are in favor of austerity. But the welfare state
is the power of the working people, of the social majority, imposed to the state and creating other institutions which are now considered to be outdated, because when now we speak, or the elite speak, or the mainstream press speaks about reforms, they mean deregulation of the labor market and dismantling of the welfare state.
Okay, thank you. Holger.
Yeah, thank you. This question about Germany banking on the Greek government falling apart, breaking up? No. First of all, I don't understand this focus on Germany. The Eurozone has never been as united as it is now, at least the 18 out of 19. That is simply a statement of fact. This is not Germany, this is not Estonia, this is 18 members of the Eurozone. Having a country which elected a new government and now no longer feels bound by the treaties or contracts or agreements which the previous government signed. That is a bit of upsetting to everybody else, of course. The German, the European, whatever you want to call it, approach is very simple. Tough love. It's the word for it. We are ready to help, and we help a lot, but we do not give money unconditionally. We do only give money attached to conditions, conditions that are supposed to make the recipient of the money better suited to grow and hence to bear its debt in the future. This is not primarily about debt, actually. If we count the debt relief which the European taxpayers have already granted to Greece, that is, if we take the one cut in debt, which was not just taxpayers, which was a lot, of course, the private sector, partly reverting back to governments, plus the cut in interest costs, plus the extension of maturities, then almost half of Greece's public debt in terms of its net present value has already been written off. And Europe is ready to do significantly more in that, if needed. But it will only do so if Greece is not turning itself into a Venezuela, but if Greece is turning itself into a modern European economy with a labor market that works, with a regulatory system that works, where it doesn't rank, what was it, 155th place, Miranda, on these league tables, but where it ranks where a developed country should belong, somewhere in the higher part of it. This is the tough love approach. It is not about debt. It's not about deficits. It's actually no longer about austerity. There was no austerity in 2014. Greece was actually allowed to have a little fiscal stimulus in 2014. This is about the structural reforms, which Miranda mentioned and which I initially mentioned. And coming to the questions about Germany, what informs the German approach or the European approach? It is experience. When I was a student at the LSE, Britain was the sick man of Europe. Look at the color of my hair, that was quite a while ago. It was a bit of macroeconomic repair, bringing inflation under control, but mostly labor market reforms, privatization and stuff like that, which turned Britain into the thriving country it has been ever since. Germany 10 years ago, 12 years ago, was the sick man of Europe. And I was not exactly liked in Berlin, put it that way, for pointing that out. A bit of macroeconomic repair, but especially labor market reforms, turned the German economy into what it is today, a structurally strong economy. The German advantage is not technology. German technology was about as good or bad as it is today in 1995, in 1998, when the German labor market was going down the drain. The German advantage is now that it is a good place to invest and create jobs. That's what a country needs to be. That is what Greece needs to be. That is where Greece was clearly heading last year. And that is where, with the current government intentions, I hope they're not realized, of making the labor market less flexible, of doing away with performance reviews in the public sector. This is exactly the stuff which would see to it, okay, that capital leaves the country instead of creating jobs in the country.
Okay, good, thank you. We have clear disagreements about models and production. Mary, would you like to... there's a microphone coming here.
Three very short points. When I was young, and I'm older than Holger, we learned that the German recovery was due to the cancellation of all debt in 1953, to continuing martial aid throughout the 1950s and 1960s, and indeed to a continuing flow of dollars as a result of the deployment of Western troops in Germany. That's point number one. Point number two, yes, Miranda's...
Go very quickly through the points.
Please. Well, I'll only have 2 points then. Okay. I can come back to the third later. Yes, Miranda is... Oh, no, I know what. Point number two, Thatcher's model, what it did was to destroy manufacturing in Britain, and the reason that we're so successful was a combination of North Sea oil and the rise of the city, and we've become a rentier state dependent on the city. Point number three, very quickly, Miranda's point, quite right, there's a huge structural problem in Greece. The structural problem is the corruption of the elite and the link to state business. Who were the corrupt elite? The very people that Holger wants to keep in power. The arrival of Syriza offers us the best opportunity that we have to deal with corruption, tax evasion, and what we ought to be doing is help them do it.
Okay, thanks. the panel may discover questions in those points. Isaac.
Isaac Arpidis, I'm a Greek correspondent based in London. The question goes to Mr. Milios. I would like to ask you, if finally in Syriza you had a plan A, not plan B, for the next day in the government, and I'm asking that because everyone admits here that the situation now is worse than in January. So do you, Syriza follows the plan you had to deal with the crisis? And if yes, is that possible to drive us out of the euro? Thank you.
Thanks very much. Gentleman here, please. Just further down the row.
Ian Beck, the European Institute of LSE. Two very short questions. The first is...
You take the microphone away.
The first is that Greece clearly needs money. It has to come from somebody. Would the panelists invest their own pensions in a Greece led by Syriza?
Okay.
Second short question is, what can Greece do to help itself rather than hoping that others will come to its rescue?
Okay, good, thanks. Let's take one more question. The gentleman right at the back. And then I'm going to come back to the upper tier later.
So austerity is often made as an argument in terms of analogies to personal finances and the idea of living beyond your means and needing to rein that in now. Does the panel think this is a fair analogy? Is this an accurate representation of the situation?
Okay, good, thank you. Right. Shall we start in the reverse order? Holger, could I ask the panelists at this stage to try to be as quick as possible, please?
Yeah, I'll try to be quick. First of all, on the German economic post-war recovery, I once read a book about that. I very much hope it's still in the library here. And I definitely think that the stuff you mentioned has virtually nothing to do with it. For the rest, see the book. Yes, every help for Greece to root out corruption, to fight tax evasion is great, and I'm not attached to any certain political force in any country. I want to see good economic sense prevail, and good economic sense is the basis for social progress. The German labor market reforms of 10, 12 years ago have now led to record employment. They have led to significant gains in wages. The thing is, you have to fix your labor market first, and then you get the rewards. You cannot have the rewards first and scare off investment in the process. And ultimately, would I invest money in a Greece run by Syriza? I don't care about parties. A Greece that signs and implements a significant deal with its creditors on pro-growth structural reforms, I would happily invest a lot of money in that. A Greece that is on course or maybe on course to turning itself into a Venezuela without the oil, I would not invest money in. I look at the policies. I don't care about parties or certain politicians in that respect.
Thank you. Yanni.
Well, plan A and plan B. As I see things, what Syriza does is a different plan. That's what Syriza tries to do. So it's a plan B, if you wish. It's a plan to stop austerity. That is to follow different policies from mainstream policies of the last decade, and especially after the outbreak of the world financial crisis. Exiting the euro, the plan of the ruling elites all over the world, and especially in the European Union and the Eurozone, is to devaluate the purchasing power of the working majority. They correctly name it in Greece internal devaluation. Devaluation through a currency devaluation of the purchasing power and the living standards of the majority of the people is not something that we wish, is not welcome. Greek people, the social majority, are not exporters. And if Greek exporters, the big all-inclusive enterprises, all the oil producers, all the basic metal producers, increase their profits through a currency devaluation, I'm not sure at all that this is going to have any positive effect to the living standards of the social majority. Second, and I finish, the elephant in the room is the ECB. The ECB does not play the role of a lender of the last resort as it plays here in Britain or in Japan due to a political decision. The problem is political. There are solutions, different solutions of the Bruegel Institute in Brussels, of the Viplos in Paris, the co-authored by me and Sotiropoulos Lapatsioras, published by the Levy Institute of Bard College in the United States, other solutions which focus on the central bank and show that there is a way to create solvency and give governments the fiscal room in order to put forward different policies, welfare policies. We do not have a dilemma, either solvency or austerity. There are other ways.
Could you respond perhaps directly to Ian's question? Would you advise Greeks to keep their money in Greek banks? If you have money, would you invest in Greece at the present time?
I think that very soon we are going to reach a solution, a win-win solution. This is my hope, and this is what I think it's going to be most probable. So after that, we are going to have to see a U-turn which is going to convince everyone that they shall invest in Greece.
Okay. Miranda.
Yes. I could detect a question to these latest three comments. Debt sustainability has three requirements. One is to eventually return to fiscal stability. The second is to make sure that the economy is competitive. And only then do you look for a debt reduction if that is needed. So the fact that Germany got a debt write-down in 1953 cannot by itself explain the post-war miracle of Germany. Germany fulfilled all three requirements, not just the haircut on the debt. It established fiscal stability and a highly competitive economy. Now, in terms of what Syriza wants to do, Syriza says, and Yanis just repeated it. They say they want to stop austerity. But it, in reality, it wants to provide social benefits with other people's money. And even though the government keeps repeating that they only want time, not money, it's money they are really after. And because the money is, the cash is running short, now they are finally starting to contemplate the reforms that were in the memorandum. It also says, Syriza also says it wants to get rid of the oligarchs, but the only way to do that is to liberalize the economy. It's to get rid of government intervention. It's to get rid of the government licensing system that has created oligopolistic industries and companies and has provided excess profits to the oligarchs. Finally, would I put my money in Greece? I have taken all my money out of the Greek banking system.
Paul, would you put your money in the Greek bank at the moment?
I'll come to that. I think it's become clear in this discussion what the a better definition of austerity. Austerity is not a a series of years in which you you tax more and spend less. Austerity is the project of the global elite. And it's the project to force down living standards, to destroy social solidarity, to destroy cohesion, and to reduce the wage share of the developed world to a point where capital solves the problem that became apparent in 2008 on the back of the populations. That's what austerity means, and this is what's being offered, Thatcherism and Hearts too. Thank you very much. The Greek people have already voted, and they will carry on voting overwhelmingly against that.
So, Paul, yep. you've made that point eloquently before.
Okay,
so you respond to the questions.
So the austerity, is not on, that's on offer is not going to be voted for. To come back to one of the points made earlier, the idea that Greek social democracy is going to revive, it's been destroyed by the crisis. Even a government that was Tsipras only, no Lafatsanis, with Topotami, with Papandreou, is not going to do Hearts 2 and Thatcherism. You've just got to get that out of your mind. And therefore, the international authorities are going to have to come to some kind of conclusion with them. As to whether I would invest my money in the Greek government, buy bonds in Greece, no, I wouldn't, because I know that the international authorities are bent on smashing this government. I think there is a bigger than 50% chance of a default, and default without exit first, and then followed by probably an exit. Bigger than 50%, I hope it doesn't happen. After that, yes, absolutely, buy bonds in a sovereign Greece, because a country with a currency cannot go bust in its own currency.
Okay, good, thank you. I'm going to, with the agreements of the panel, just take three more questions, if that's okay. And can we take the gentleman on the front row, please, here?
Thank you. My question, Thanasis Gavos, I'm a Greek correspondent in London. It's basically for Mr. Milios. When you speak of a win-win solution, how do you define it? Do you see the partners, the institutions backtracking on what they've been saying? Do you see the Greek government backtracking? Should the Greek government backtrack?
Okay, good, thank you. And so many hands, it's impossible. Okay, can we take the gentleman in the middle at the back, please?
Hi. It seems to me that...
Just give us your name.
Sorry, Hamish McLeod. That one of you is talking in the language of Marxism and the other three in various shades of conventional market economy. So, and they have different value systems.
You found the presentation of Paul Mason, the neoliberal philosophy?
I'm going on background. I mean, I'm not taking him as a Marxist.
Okay.
So if you're talking completely different languages, how can you possibly ever come to an agreement?
My sentiments exactly. Okay, can we take the lady over here, please?
Hello, my name is Vanessa Paspatis. Thank you, everybody, for very interesting points, especially Mr. Paul Mason. It's very refreshing to hear a non-Greek express the views of a lot of Greek people. I wouldn't say everyone, but a lot of Greek people. I think before we answer the question of whether austerity is winning the argument on recovery, I think we need to agree on the definition of recovery. And if we all think the same thing of recovery, my question is to the German economist. I happen to be half Irish, half Greek, so there's no escape for me, basically. You said before that, and both Ms. Safar said the same as well, that we were on a very good track until Syriza arrived. I'm not going to go into the political parties. I would vote for.
Give us a question.
Yes, I would vote for anyone who makes a change for Greece. But can you please give me a definition of how successful we were before Syriza arrived, when wages go down? More than at any time, people, young people, have left Greece and are abroad trying to find work. And when people who have worked all their lives and paid, one moment please, paid for their pensions are now having their pensions slashed. So can you please give me a definition of success?
That's fine. Thanks very much. Can we take the gentleman at the front here, please?
Hello, my name is Andreas Kudras. I've got a question for the whole panel. In view of the fact that I think most of you agree that the debt is not a problem in Greece, currently anyway, do you think that a negotiated exit with a dowry, together with perhaps a commitment by the ECB to protect the new drachma from a rapid devaluation, is a possible way out or not?
Okay, good, thanks. And then finally, if we could take the lady up here, please.
Hello, my name's Irene Kavouris. Thank you for the very interesting points by everyone. I was touching on what Miranda said about growth and potential. Are there industries specifically like petroleum, oil, natural gas, or natural resources which Greece hasn't really tapped into that could be developed, or some other for other type of industry? Because obviously austerity, and I really don't know how to phrase this, but you need growth as well as reduction in deficit. That's my question.
Okay, good. Yanni, what is a win-win solution?
Well, Syriza has two mandates. First, to stay in the Eurozone and stabilize the economy by stopping wage cuts, dismantling of social care, health care, and so on. And second, to have an agreement with European partners in order to cover the needs for financing the Greek state in order to repay the institutions themselves, the European Central Bank, and so on. So a win-win solution for the Greek government is going to be that it will they will find an equilibrium between these two mandates. Now, the second question, which was very close to it, is how can people who speak different languages find a solution? But we, first of all, you know that I'm not a member of the government, I'm a member of the party. In left parties, the party is always something different from the government. I have chosen to do so for certain reasons. One of the main reasons is that the party is something different and plays an important role compared to the government.
But now we are speaking about agreements on very specific measures of policy. This does not have to do directly if one is a Keynesian and the other one is a post-Keynesian or anything else. I would say again something that I said before, but somehow differently. 10% of the Chinese people in this very unequal country are 130 million. 130 million is 10% of the Chinese society. These people buy Western cars, and they mostly buy German cars. They do not buy Lexus or other Japanese cars due to some geopolitical problems of the two countries, but among the European cars, they choose to buy the German cars, not because they are cheap, but because the Chinese people, as other people, think that these cars are of high quality. If you continue with low cost, labor cost policies in Southern Europe, you are forcing Southern Europe to continue producing goods of medium quality or of medium technology or low technology, and be constantly pushed away by China or the other countries of Southeast Asia, which nowadays produce exactly these goods.
Okay, good, thanks. Miranda, would it be best for Greece to exit and for the ECB to give Greece a dowry?
Certainly not. Certainly not. Unfortunately, if Greece exits, the ECB will not be running monetary policy in Greece, and I would certainly not trust the same political system that drove the deficit to 15% of GDP to run monetary policy. Unlike Paul, I also would not buy GGBs, Greek government bonds, if Greece has its own currency, because even though it's true that you cannot default if you have your own currency, it is also true that you can certainly inflate your debts away.
Okay. Holger, the signs of recovery, what recovery? What do you mean by recovery?
First of all, let me remind you of the first part of my presentation. When it came to Greece, serious mistakes were made in the program. Jointly, the Greek administrations and the institutions found it easier to raise taxes than to issue more taxi licenses, to streamline bureaucratic procedures, to make Greece a better place to invest. That was a mistake. And the failure to introduce, say, a flat tax, do the turnaround like Slovakia, which was also a weakish administration part, to do not the Baltic kind of reforms, was a joint failure of the Greek administrations of the time and the Troika. So the recession was unnecessarily deep, with an unnecessarily steep rise in unemployment. However, over the course of 2013, austerity ended. Over the course of 2014, there was no more austerity. The economic situation of Greece in the autumn of 2014, and now allow me to read some boring economic statistics to you about the rebound which Greece had until the Syriza threat came. The situation was GDP in the first three quarters of 2014 rising at an annualized pace of 2.3%. Pretty good. A 1.6% year-over-year employment in Greece in the third quarter of 2014. A 2.8% year-over-year gain in real wages in the third quarter of 2014 in Greece after steep falls before. A 7.0% rise in real exports year-on-year in the third quarter of 2014. A primary fiscal surplus. Again, after serious mistakes in the earlier years, in 2014, Greece was on the road to recovery until I showed that in my chart, Spain continued its recovery, whereas Greece, as of December last year, started to fall back into recession. One brief issue, negotiated exit from the euro. The thing is, if you can negotiate an exit, if you can actually agree with Europe, you don't need to leave the euro. That's the thing. Then you can have all the benefits of low interest rate, institutional stability, and all the things that come with being part of the euro. If you cannot negotiate with Europe, then, unfortunately, that would be very, very tough on Greece. The result would be serious inflation, which is the worst shock to social justice you can imagine. Because then rich outsiders can buy Greece on the cheap, and the poor insiders have the value of their wages, pensions, and welfare benefits eroded by inflation. Grexit, or a policy that raises the risk of a Grexit, is the worst possible social policy imaginable.
Okay thanks. Paul, given everything you were saying before about ECB policy, is Grexit the best option in these current circumstances?
No, it isn't. And when I said there was a greater than 50% possibility, I didn't mean that I was advocating it. It was the hypothetical question, when would I put my money in? I think all the things that Holger has just said are true. I think we are probably days away from a decision on this, though, because I think that in Greek society and in Greek politics, you know, given what I said about the hollowing out and absence of a social democracy and the current split and chaos within conservatism, if, as is likely, the left of Syriza comes forward with exactly that, I think that's what they're going to propose. The next gambit will be a plan, a resolution that says we argue for an amicable Grexit, you know, a sort of a managed, dowry-based, agreed Grexit. Don't be surprised if that gets a lot of traction inside the left of Greek society. I would counsel against it because of all the things that Holger said. It wouldn't be very easy to be outside. But let's again be clear about who is creating the situation. Either Greece is a brilliant country that was recovering and can recover with its current structural problems, or it's not. And I can't decide what Greece's critics think of it at the moment. It seems to me that it, in fact, you know, the recovery was there, but it wasn't, you know, therefore why did the ECB and IMF come forward with a demand for a massive hike in the primary surplus if they wanted to sustain the recovery? No, the change in attitude comes from, and it's not even from Brussels, it is from Frankfurt. I think it is from Frankfurt. I think that there isn't a unanimity. We're seeing two camps within the Eurozone, and the camp that wants to push Greece out is very firm. It's based around, it is Germany and its allies. The reason I'm posing it so starkly is because we're all part of this state. Even Brits have a stake in the European project. And once it's destroyed, we can't go back and as we did in the 1980s, my generation thought we were creating a kind of nice European place where we would all have interchange and solidarity. Once somebody has pressed the button on the destruction of the zone first and the solidarity between nations second, it's not going to be very easy to recreate it. And therefore, I come back to, if you are the stewards of this system, if you are the central bank of the system, why would you allow the election of a party you don't like to tip you from seeing the country as quite good and improving to relentlessly stoking a bank run among its citizens? Why would you do that other than your desire to smash the government, which is the only government inside Europe that resists the global austerity project?
Okay, I suspect that none of us came to the debate expecting an easy consensus and convergence of minds, and we fully delivered on the absence of convergence between our speakers. But hopefully you've come away better informed of the different positions. So I'm afraid we're now way over time. Could I ask you please to thank each of our speakers for a very interesting debate?